So today on the Loopcast, I have Dr. Laura C. With me at Texas in Africa, and we're talking about U.S. foreign policy towards Africa. So previous in our series in Africa, we usually just pick very specific topics, you know, China and Africa or AFRICOM. But today we want to sort of try to understand, you know, U.S. foreign policy towards Africa, if one, you know, such idea exists. So I want to maybe start off with giving us a history or an overview of what you see as U.S. foreign policy towards Africa. I mean, you know, what are sort of the drivers and what are some of the concepts and ideas behind how the U.S. sort of conceptualizes foreign policy towards the continent?
Sure, that's a great question. I mean, I think that you have to think in terms of the historical context. Of course, it's the Cold War that looms large. And that is because the project of decolonization of Africa essentially happened simultaneous to the development of the Cold War. So from day one, you know, these brand new countries that are led by mostly by nationalist leaders who had, some of whom had to actually fight to get independence, but others of whom had been struggling and protesting and jailed and all these kinds of things that had gone on in the sort of the 30s to the 50s. The U.S. never looks at Africa outside of the Cold War context because there is nothing to develop in the pre-Cold War period. The U.S. did have diplomatic relations with Liberia, of course, which is founded in the early 1800s on the west coast of Africa as a haven for freed slaves who were sent back to the continent by the American Colonization Society. We had some relationships with Ethiopia and with South Africa. But other than that, all these countries were brand new. And so immediately the framework that took was, you know, are you on our side or you're on the Soviet side? And to some extent, the Chinese. And of course, when the Sino-Soviet split happens in 1962, which is also very, very early in the period of African independence. And this kind of, are you democratic? Are you capitalistic? Are you with us or are you against us? And there really wasn't a lot of room in the United States Cold War conception of Africa for kind of middle ground. Certainly, this is when the non-aligned movement is going on, and African states are playing leadership roles in the non-aligned movement. But the dynamics are very much about trying to build relationships and win friends and influence countries to vote in the UN with the United States, but also for very direct geostrategic reasons. And a lot of that has to do with a couple of issues. One is control of the Suez Canal, and the other is the radio relay listening system, which was used to listen in on the Soviets. But one of the most convenient ways, so with the technology at that time before satellites were developed, we would relay messages across the African continent. There is a place in what's now Eritrea, up on a very high altitude plateau that is this kind of geological freak of nature that they can get radio signals from almost anywhere in the world. And so there was a U.S. military presence there listening in on what the Soviets were doing and what their allies were doing in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe. But those become less strategically important as technology advances. And by the late Cold War, the U.S. is really kind of in a, I don't know if you'd call it a dilemma exactly, but we're certainly in a position by that point of everyone being very well aware that we are supporting and propping up some people who have not, whose commitment to democracy was maybe in name only, who are not committed, you know, to free voting rights or to free speech or having any of the markers of a democratic society. So, you know, the very famous examples, people like Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire, Congo, several dictators in West Africa. I mean, the view was we'll let them do what they want within their country as long as they stay on our side. in Cold War terms. And when Reagan comes along with his rollback program, so Reagan is not content just with containing the Soviet threat. He wants to push it back. So he starts arming groups. Of course, this is the most famous examples of this involve like the Contras in Nicaragua, the fight with the Sandinistas, all that stuff. But this is going on in Africa too. And the United States, both with Reagan and with some of his predecessors, becomes very deeply embroiled, mostly through the supply of weapons and expertise in conflicts on the Horn of Africa, with Somalia and Ethiopia, in the wars in Angola that, of course, the South Africans are involved in, and the Cubans are involved in as well. I mean, it's kind of a mess, and we have people fighting for countries and leaders and causes that are pretty contrary to, you know, things that the United States says it values most in terms of foreign policy. And then the Cold War ends, and suddenly there is no need to support these nasty people anymore. And that's exactly what the United States does. We withdraw support from people like Mobutu, from, you know, these nasty dictators, from these nasty wars. And it's kind of an open question in the early 1990s what U.S. foreign policy in general is going to look at. I mean, leaders definitely kind of struggle, and I think still struggle, to come up with a grand strategy. But in Africa, you know, of course, the earliest example is there was this idea right after the Cold War that maybe we could use U.S. military might, which, you know, we have the greatest capacity of any military in the history of the world, and they have nothing to do now that the Soviets are gone. At least we think they have nothing to do at that point in time. And so why not use them for like humanitarian missions, humanitarian good? Of course, that's what leads to U.S. involvement in Somalia, which then leads to the Black Hawk Down disaster, which then leads to no American appetite whatsoever for humanitarian intervention if we can avoid it. And U.S. policy in Africa after that 1993 incident, so the Black Hawk Down incident happens in October of 93, and the approach after that is very much one of kind of staying out of trouble in Africa, providing humanitarian assistance. So we'll fund aid, we'll fund development assistance, but we don't want to be involved in this anymore. We don't want to take military action. We don't want to, risk any American lives. We don't want to have American boots on the ground. And that's pretty much how it proceeds. I guess you could say until 1998 or so. A couple of things happen in 98. One is that the Clinton administration, so we're starting to deal with the Al-Qaeda emerging threat. And actually, August 7th, today is the 16th anniversary of the U.S. Embassy bombing that we, you know, later, that's where we learned who Osama bin Laden was for many of us who study Africa. They blew up the embassies. They killed 224 people, most of them Kenyans and Tanzanians, and a few, I think, 12 Americans as well. But it was something that kind of woke up, you know, U.S. policymakers that maybe we weren't going to be able to ignore Africa or keep it a completely low priority, but that still didn't make Africa a high priority. I mean, I don't want to overstate the extent to which that was. I mean, most of the discussion was about, okay, how do we make the embassy safer? How do we secure them? Of course, after 9/11, that becomes a much, much bigger issue, and Congress is much more willing to fund those embassy upgrades after 2001. And so that's when you start to see the creation of these kind of Fortress America facilities that nobody can approach. Whereas, you know, most of the embassies in Africa prior to that had been city locations on a downtown street, very accessible, very visible. They would have, you know, facilities that people could come into and use the library, that kind of thing. And that changes pretty radically after terrorism becomes an issue. The wars that were going on in Africa in the 1990s and early 2000s, there were definitely U.S. responses to this, but the responses were, we don't want to be involved in responding. We would rather it be the case that African armies respond. And so we start some small training programs. There's something called the African Crisis Response Initiative, which is morphed into something today we call a CODA, where we have, you know, U.S. military personnel training African militaries, helping them to professionalize, helping them to respond to new types of warfare, insurgency-type threats, terrorism. But the view is very much that the U.S. is going to largely stay out of the continent. Under George W. Bush, we definitely see the expansion of humanitarianism in a lot of ways, particularly with the PEPFAR initiative to provide more antiretroviral drugs to people living with HIV/AIDS. And in this period, but particularly moving into the Obama administration, you see the increasing militarization of U.S. policy in Africa. And that is largely due to the impression and the development, the idea that there is terrorist activity going on the continent, and that groups in other parts of the world are using African states, particularly the places that are, you know, what we call areas of limited governance, so where governments are not fully in control of their territory, places like Somalia, and there's this impression that those are being used as training and recruiting grounds, you know, for folks who come to fight in places like Yemen or Afghanistan or any other number of the kind of hot spots around the world. And so what we've seen over the last kind of 5, 6, 7 years is an increasing U.S. military presence, still a small one. It's there may be 5,000 people on the entire continent, 5,000 U.S. military personnel on the continent at any given time. Very secretive, very difficult to get information about how much money is being spent on this, who's spending it, what they're doing with that money. There's not very much transparency in that regard. But that's kind of where we stand today. There's a lot of this kind of behind the scenes stuff going on, trying to assist African militaries in routing out terror threats.
So I'm sort of interested in comparing Obama and Bush, because it seems like under Bush, you had a lot more involvement, or at least it seems like you had a lot more involvement in the Sudan, in humanitarian efforts. You've already mentioned healthcare, but it seems like with Obama, it's much more reliance on AFRICOM and being involved, not just in a humanitarian sense, but also military. But then I want to also add the concept of aid versus trade, because it also seems like with the African summit, that Obama seems to be, this administration seems to, at least to somebody like me, a layman, they seem to be moving from aid into more trade, into sort of, for lack of a better phrase, mimicking China and their engagement with the continent in terms of creating programs to create infrastructure, engaging in terms of pushing small to medium businesses out onto the continent. So, I mean, sort of compare if for us Bush's foreign policy versus Obama and the sort of shift into being more involved, what seems like more involvement on the continent.
Yeah, that's a great question as well. I think it's a little bit hard to compare them because, of course, they're operating in two different times, right? And global events and events in Africa are quite different in 2001 when Bush takes office than they are today in 2014. So, you know, of course the responses are going to be different. Of course the shape that takes is going to be different. But I think that, you know, thinking about it from the perspective of many kind of ordinary Africans, civil society leaders, that kind of people, Obama is seen as much less engaged with Africa than Bush was. Maybe the Africa summit will change some of those perceptions, but the general perception is that Bush was pretty deeply engaged, and that's particularly true with the effort to fight HIV/AIDS with the PEPFAR program. I mean, I really don't think it's easy now to forget how dire the situation was with HIV/AIDS, particularly in Southern Africa. I mean, you had countries in Southern Africa with prevalence rates of 30 to 35% of reproductive age adults. So if you can imagine, one of every three people ages 15 to 45 has HIV. And is going to die because they don't have access to antiretroviral drugs. They're going to die, and their children are going to die if it was transmitted to them at birth. And it was so bad. You can imagine the compounding effects of those kinds of, that kind of social crisis. I mean, this is not just a public health emergency. Who's age 15 to 45? It's your teachers, it's your lawyers, it's your doctors, it's your policemen, it's your truck drivers, right? It's the people who make an economy work and the people who are at the most productive stage of their lives. And to wipe out a third of that, just the effects, I mean, it was disastrous. People were predicting like civil wars that would come out of AIDS, essentially, you know, the society, level of societal disruption that it would cause. And when PEPFAR came in, simultaneous with other efforts by the international community, and said, you know what, we're gonna find a way to make this work, and we are going to write off some of the stuff that Clinton had resisted, but finally came around to, of allowing the generic drugs to be brought in, so that antiretrovirals could be distributed at a much, much lower cost to those who couldn't afford to buy them on their own. This revolutionized HIV care across the continent, and particularly, again, in Southern Africa and these places that were just devastated by the disease. And Obama comes in, and, you know, there's nothing that parallels that in what the Obama administration has done. And because of Obama's heritage, because of his father being Kenyan, there were these really, really high expectations that, you know, if Bush could do this much, how much more was Obama going to do? He's a son of Africa, right? Now, there's not a birther movement in Africa like there is in the United States. Nobody thinks he's actually an African, you know, born in Africa or whatever. But there is this view that because you come from this, because you are Black, because you are the first Black president, you should have a special affinity for the African continent. And so there were expectations that he was going to do a lot more. And that didn't materialize. And in some ways, it's kind of surprising. I mean, if you think about who is around Obama, who's advising him, right? So the current national security advisor, former U.S. ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, her background is in Africa, and particularly in security affairs in Africa. She had served in the Clinton administration in the Defense Department as an official for Africa. African relations. You have Samantha Power, who serves as an advisory role in the campaign, gets in a little trouble over some remarks about Hillary Clinton, but, you know, now is serving as a U.S. ambassador. I mean, these are people who deeply care about the continent, who have a history of engagement and knowing about the crises there. And you would think that the engagement would be higher than it was, but it hasn't been, and most of the engagement has been this kind of increasing militarization and increasing presence of troops. Now, part of that is a response to events. Who could have predicted, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, right? Like, who could have predicted what would happen in northern Mali a couple of years ago? I don't think the U.S. had much choice but to respond to those events and to support the African governments that are trying to respond to them. But on the kind of on the humanitarian side and on the side of just sort of just even just engagement, just like paying attention to what's going on in the continent and making it a higher priority for the U.S., I think there's a lot of disappointment and disillusionment with Obama. Now on the trade instead of aid issue. This is one of those things. I mean, this was the focus at the Africa Summit this week. It was it's kind of the approach, this idea that private investment, building up economies, creating industrialization and manufacturing capacities, integrating Africa into the global service economy, getting people, I mean, basically this comes down to getting people sustainable jobs, right? Where you have people who are well-educated who now maybe can't find a job or can't get the capital to start the kind of business that would give them a job and that they're very smart and very clever to have come up with. I mean, I think this partly is a response to some changes in approach to development that are worldwide. There's a lot more sort of evidence-based approach. And I mean, we know people need jobs to get out of poverty, right? Like, this is not—it's not rocket science. That's what gets people out of poverty, not just kind of creating you know, just giving money, giving money, giving money, and nothing ever gets better. You've got to give people livelihood beyond subsistence level agriculture. They've got to have something that brings in cash and that enables them to pay for their kids to go to school, pay for health care, and get out of poverty. And that could be, if these things work, if all these pledges that they announced this week, if these, you know, $14 billion in investment that they've touted so heavily, if that works, it could be a really great legacy for Obama. But it's also, I mean, at the same time, you have to say, you know, this is very late in his administration. We're a little over 2 years out from the election. And I think that the fact that this is coming so late, even like the optics of holding your summit in August when Congress is out of town, half the city is on, you know, is on holiday, is at the beach this week. That suggests that Africa is just not a very high priority for Obama, that it's not something that he is particularly engaged with, particularly animated by, and it's something that sort of comes as an afterthought when the more important and more serious issues have, at least in his, you know, perception, have been dealt with.
Interesting. So I want to sort of shift gears and talk about AFRICOM. So, I mean, it seems like in the last, you know, during this administration that we've ramped up sort of the military presence on the continent. So, I mean, where do we factor in AFRICOM and this military engagement with sort of the broader view of U.S. foreign policy? I mean, is this, do we consider AFRICOM sort of a, you know, a positive sort of movement towards engagement, or are we sort of saying that it's really, you know, it's a product of sort of, you know, counterterrorism efforts, you know, in the Horn of Africa, you know, sort of place AFRICOM within this context that you've developed for us.
Yeah, so this is the question for the sort of Africa watcher crowd. A lot of the kind of old school scholars and diplomats are pretty wary of AFRICOM. These are people who remember watching firsthand, you know, the mess, quite frankly, that the United States created in many African, as well as Latin American and Asian states during the Cold War, where, you know, the CIA basically kind of ran rampant and did truly horrible things, truly destabilized countries, removed democratically elected leaders. I mean, that's how Mobutu came to power, for example, in Congo, Zaire. There's a lot of fear that a militarized approach will kind of run roughshod over the African people and over what their priorities are, and that it can be, you know, the kind of assistance that AFRICOM provides could turn out to be just another way of strengthening bad leaders, strengthening autocrats, giving them excuses not to hold democratic elections because they need to stay in power, right? Because it's too dangerous for them not to be in power in their calculation. At least those are the claims that they would make. And so I think there's a real fear that this is quite dangerous and that this could actually lead to more destabilization down the line, even if we can't really predict that right now. The counterpoint to that is that, you know, this might be an opportunity to use American military might for some good. And when you're dealing with some of the African armies, some of them are, you know, the Rwandan army, there are a few African armies that are quite professional and quite capable. I think that, you know, we've seen the Tanzanians and South Africans fight quite well as peacekeepers in Congo, the same thing with the Rwandans in Darfur, to some extent the Ugandans in Somalia. But many African armies, many African armies, excuse me, are disasters. I mean, they're under-equipped, they're under-trained, morale is very low. The soldiers sometimes, in some places, you know, they can't march in straight lines. I mean, they show up drunk to morning, you know, roll call or whatever. They don't show up for roll call at all unless it's payday and they think they might get a check. You know, places where the state is very weak and where the armies are kind of a mess, it's not a good idea as an army that isn't disciplined and happy, you know, that makes you quite prone to a coup. And if AFRICOM can come into those situations and help to instill discipline, to teach modern norms of fighting wars, to teach things like respect for human rights, that you don't just get to go in and run over the people, but there are certain expectations of how a military should behave in a democratic society and what civilian control actually means. I think that can be a good thing. I think in places like Congo, Somalia, where you're trying to rebuild a military into a disciplined force, that can do some good. But it has to come with a lot of caution and a lot of regulation and a lot of oversight. And I'm not sure how much that we see with AFRICOM. But on the flip side of that, I mean, I think there's this view that a lot of people who maybe are just kind of looking at it at a surface level, like, oh, you know, AFRICOM, the Defense Department, we can't trust them. And they don't understand that AFRICOM was not really created to engage in combat. The purpose of AFRICOM was much more emphasizing this training role and that kind of thing. Most of AFRICOM's budget is not in the Defense Department, it's in the State Department. The idea was very much that this is going to be security cooperation, military diplomacy, you know, if that's not a contradiction in terms. But that's how Congress wanted the money to be spent, and that was the original conception behind AFRICOM. The changing nature of threats mean that is having to change. So AFRICOM, again, not set up to be a combat command, did not have like troops ready to deploy in an emergency. When the French jumped the gun in Libya, all of a sudden they have to stand up in the operation, right? Now we don't have like a major boots on the ground presence in that situation, but they were essentially just kind of pulling military operations out of thin air to get that ready, and to get involved, you know, very, very quickly. And as AFRICOM, as what the administration and what Congress want AFRICOM to do becomes more hands-on, becomes more combat-oriented. I think that it's a complicated time for AFRICOM. And you compound that with the fact that, you know, there are really not that many people in the Defense Department who have Africa experience. It's not the Middle East, where you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who have fought there. You have linguists, you have all the, you know, cultural experts, you have all the kind of skills, you have anthropologists who are embedded. They don't have that for comp. I think there are people working to build that capacity, but it's very much a kind of flying by the seat of their pants situation at times, and people are trying their best to sort of pull something together, but the expectations about what AFRICOM do, both from Congress and the administration, but also from, you know, sort of Africans, especially those who think that, you know, AFRICOM is up to no good. I mean, I think there's kind of a gross overstatement of what AFRICOM is actually capable of doing right now. But that doesn't mean in the future that might not happen. And maybe a good example of these, you know, questionable expectations is the hunt for Joseph Cohn, the warlord who heads up the LRA. So we've had these American advisors deployed, you know, for nearly 3 years now. They still haven't found like a high. They're traipsing around the jungle in eastern Congo and southeastern Central African Republic, looking for this one warlord who has maybe 200 people behind him at this point. And a lot of those are going to be children, child soldiers. It's kind of ridiculous, right, that we're spending those resources on this one guy. But Africa policy is heavily influenced by social movements in the United States, by advocacy organizations. They are able to get attention, and they're able to present their agenda without a lot of opposition up front. So, you know, nobody ever came to Congress and said hunting for the LRA would be a bad thing, right? It's you never got both sides of the issue. I mean, and we can think about a lot of areas where lobbying has a big impact on U.S. policy, right? So Israel-Palestine is probably a really good example of that. But when there's a question relating to what to do in Israel-Palestine, you can be sure that every possible point of view has been aired before Congress in the court of public opinion. Whereas with Africa policy, you know, members of Congress don't know much about Africa by and large. The general American public knows even less. There's no organized pressure groups on multiple sides. So when a grassroots advocacy campaign does take off, like the anti-LRE movement, and this is before the Kony 2012 film, because this legislation was passed in 2000 that has led to the deployment of these advisors. It was funded, you know, long ago, but, well, it wasn't exactly funded. The funding came out of other Defense Department funds. The advocacy organizations set the narrative, and nobody ever said otherwise to policymakers. And so we end up with AFRICOM and, you know, other parts of the military being asked to do these things that maybe haven't been fully vetted or haven't been, you know, fully thought through. It's all the reasons, and particularly on the side of what could go wrong. And I think that leaves them with a really, really significant challenge in trying to do their jobs and do it well.
No, you've touched on something very interesting, the idea of congressional involvement in forming policy towards Africa. Is Congress really involved then? I mean, you made the point that there's no real pressure groups for both sides of an issue. So, I mean, how would you describe congressional involvement? Is it really, does it follow the line of various lobby groups, or is there sort of pushback and Congress is sort of able, and you have the competent staffers who are able to inform lawmakers of, you know, of all sides of an issue, or is it really just follows the line of various lobby groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be an oversimplification to say that the lobby groups get everything that they want. The advocates, they don't. But when you're talking about the way that Africa policy is dealt with, right? So you have one subcommittee in the House and one subcommittee in the Senate of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And the chair and the ranking member on each of those committees usually have a staffer whose job it is to deal with Africa-related issues. That may not be their full portfolio, right? So they may have other things they have to spend their time on as well. But that one staffer has to know about any potential issue involving the continent that might pop up at any given time. And then you have, for each committee, for each party, there will be a professional staffer whose job is to also be informed about whatever goes on in Africa. So at Senate Foreign Relations, you'll have the Africa guy for the Republicans and the Africa woman for the Democrats, that kind of thing. There is no way that you know, one person or even three people could have the level of expertise I don't have the expertise to explain everything in Africa to you, right? It's so complicated, and these situations are so complex that they have to take shortcuts and they have to take assistance. And so, you know, when advocacy groups come along, I think the Save Darfur movement is a pretty good example of this. Save Darfur movement presents a very simple narrative of what's going on in Sudan in circa 2003-2005. They call it genocide, although, you know, people who study what kind of the legal definition of genocide is definitely came back and pushed back against that and disputed it. But it's a very powerful narrative, right? And it's a very, like, you need to pay attention to this. And there's really no reason to be opposed to it. Like, we all think genocide is bad, right? And so if the advocacy group can successfully present a narrative and successfully gain enough grassroots attention that members of Congress are getting calls about the issue, being asked to do, you know, more or less the same thing about the issue, it's very easy for that shortcut to be taken, because it's the, you know, it's easier. It's easier, and it's there's no reason to disbelieve it. I mean, nobody was lobbying members of Congress, this isn't really a genocide, and it's that doesn't mean that the mass atrocities aren't bad, but you also have atrocities being committed by the gem and by, you know, people who are fighting on the other side, and it's quite a complex situation. I mean, that doesn't happen, because the only people saying that are like academics, right, or civil society leaders in the country. So another example, one that I personally research is the case of conflict minerals in the Eastern Congo. So these are minerals that armed groups benefit from mining and sale of in Eastern Congo. And there's been a very powerful advocacy movement that got a lot of grassroots support. And, you know, Congress went along with it because the advocacy movement was backed by a group called the MF Project, which is part of the Center for American Progress, which is a liberal democratic advocacy organization in Washington, D.C. And if you're a member of Congress being asked to think about an issue in the DR Congo, and the think tank, the lobby group that your side, in this case the Democrats, trust, tells you, hey, this is what's up in this situation, and our idea here will fix it. You know, there was no opposition, or very little opposition, to getting the legislation through, which it came out as a rider on the Dodd-Frank bill, Section 1502. But nobody ever came to, like, members of the Congressional Black Caucus who all voted in favor of this. Nobody ever came to them and said, you know, actually, there's a lot of opposition to this idea among Congolese civil society leaders, and we don't think it'll work, and here are the reasons why. That didn't happen. There's no kind of organized opposition. And so, yeah, I mean, I would argue, this is the topic of my next book, I would argue that advocacy organizations working on Africa are able to have outsized influence on these processes, and are able to really push their agendas through sometimes without a lot of opposition, and that can sometimes have positive consequences, but sometimes have quite negative consequences, because if the advocacy organization gets it wrong, there's no check on that.
So I want to maybe bring our conversation back to the beginning, but with a different context. In the beginning of our talk, we talked about the Cold War context of U.S. involvement, at least U.S. involvement in Africa during the Cold War, and how it was sort of shaped by the Soviet involvement. And so I want to sort of maybe pose a question this way. You know, what has been the U.S.'s reaction towards Chinese involvement on the continent now? I mean, I think the popular line is, you know, it's sort of a Cold War between the United States and China now over economic influence. I think that's sort of the extreme view of it. But, you know, where do we factor in China into U.S. foreign policy? I mean, is it, you know, is it bound to be this rivalry on the continent? Is it, you know, each power has its own sort of separate sphere of influence? I mean, where do we put China in U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, everybody wants there to be a new Cold War in Africa. No, I think that it's an interesting question to think about the counterfactual. You know, would there have been an Africa summit this week has China's engagement not grown in the continent in the last 15 years? Maybe, maybe not, right? Who knows? The investments that were announced this week, the total amount of investment in the United States, I mean, it's tiny compared to what the Chinese are putting into the continent. But at the same time, what the Chinese are doing in Africa and how they see their relationship to Africa, it's just totally different than what the U.S. does. And this is particularly in terms of you know, what form aid and investment take. United States assistance to Africa is humanitarian and development oriented. So we will put funding into buying and distributing antiretroviral drugs for children living with HIV/AIDS. We will put money into, you know, helping people to dig wells so that they have access to clean drinking water, or to buying mosquito nets so people don't get malaria. That's what the U.S. does. That is not what China does. China's approach to engagement in the continent is largely centered around economic investment. You have people migrating to the continent with the idea that they're going to stay permanently. You know, there are very few Americans who do that, but Chinese, that, I mean, it's, you know, Howard French's new book, I think, explains very well what's going on there. They're going to create businesses, they're going to create jobs, and this is where they're going to be, and this is going to create a market for Chinese products, but also a growing relationship between, you know, the continent's different countries and the Chinese state. When the Chinese do things that are sort of in the public interest of African citizens, it tends to be infrastructure development, which the United States really is fairly limited in its involvement in these days. So the Power Africa initiative is interesting, you know, this effort to increase access to electricity, rural electrification efforts, those kinds of things. I mean, that's an exception and not the rule to what the U.S. does when it's in Africa. The Chinese, the U.S. is never going, USAID is not going to pave roads. They are not going to build or rebuild railways. They are probably not going to build a dam to generate hydroelectric power, although that may change. There are some suggestions that we might get involved in that kind of stuff. But, you know, the U.S. doesn't do these things, and that's what China does. So it's, I mean, I think it's kind of comparing apples to oranges in a sense, that you're really looking at two different things. But at the same time, I think there's no question that African leaders see China's engagement in the continent as giving them another really viable option for international partnership and as a way to attract investment and attract assistance. And, you know, there are things about China that the Chinese don't really care if you're democratic or not. They don't really care if you have regular elections. I mean, they're quite appealing to some autocratic African leaders, quite frankly. And so it's not exactly a competition, but it's not exactly not a competition either, I guess is the way that I would say it.
But I mean, it seems within the narrative or the story of China's rise on the continent, it does seem like there's a critique of U.S. foreign policy towards Africa. I mean, it almost seems like, you know, China built their influence from the ground up, that, you know, either through the network of migrants, either through forming, you know, sort of long-standing relationships, you know, when I was talking about this with Howard French, it almost seems like China is in it for the long game, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. Whereas it almost seems like with the U.S., it's not only very heavy top-down, but it almost seems like there's, you know, a flyover sort of way of conducting policy. You know, you're there for, you know, one project, or you're there for maybe a year or 2 years, but you're never there. You know, the U.S. doesn't intend to be there for 5, 10, 15, you know, basically, you know, the life of a whole generation. So, I mean, you know, can we consider China's rise on the continent as sort of maybe a critique of how U.S. foreign policy towards Africa is conducted?
I don't know. I don't know if that's a fair assessment or not. I mean, I think that if you look at China's initial engagement in the continent in this kind of round of their engagement, because, of course, they've been engaged in the past, it wasn't exactly about the U.S. I mean, it was really about creating markets for Chinese goods and also creating places to get Chinese jobs, right, which is the complete obsession of leaders in Beijing. You've got to give – if you're going to have a population that large, you've got to keep everybody employed if you're going to keep them from rising up and overthrowing the Communist Party. I mean, that's the basic logic of China, right, of the Chinese leadership. And so they will create whatever kind of absurd jobs they can. And anybody to Beijing will tell you that. You know, you go visit the Forbidden City and you pass through four ticket gates instead of one. It makes no sense. But there's a person at each thing to tear off your tab, and they have a job. And so it does make sense. I think that was what it was about. It wasn't really like taking aim at U.S. assistance and trying to set it up as a at the competition. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that it does, whether it was intended to or not, it does challenge the U.S. approach to Africa. It does have this long game in mind, and it does think about development very much in the way that development happened in China itself, right? It's just this effort to put massive investments into infrastructure and industrialization in order to accelerate development, to make it happen much more quickly than it unfolded, say, in Western Europe during the Industrial Revolution. And quite frankly, given what we know about how people get out of poverty, that's probably the right approach. Now, that's not to say it's not fraught with problems. Environmental degradation, you know, autocracy, all kinds of stuff. But thinking about this in long term, thinking about long term infrastructure investment, thinking about what the long game is. It really kind of emphasizes how short-sighted U.S. policy in Africa is, and how short-sighted, you know, general development policy in Africa is, where things tend to happen on sort of 2-year contracts, 5-year contracts. But when you think about the massive task of modernizing and developing countries, that's the kind of thing that takes, you know, hundreds of years and at least 50 years if you want to try to accelerate it through these kinds of massive investments. And so, yeah, I think that's a fair critique in that particular sense.
So I think we've sort of reached the end of the interview, and usually what we try to do is have the guest offer us a sort of last word or some sort of thing to think on. So if you can, before we sign off, just leave us with a last word or something to think about before we sign off.
Okay. I think the big challenge for U.S. policy going forward in Africa is how we address this continent that is full of young people, bright ideas, growing middle classes, young professionals, people who are coming up with really brilliant ways to solve problems in the continent. But they are led by leaders who are old men wanting to hold on to their power. And that is a huge disconnect between this sort of forward-thinking and backward-thinking, forward-thinking populations, backward-thinking leadership. I think that's going to provoke tension in the years ahead, and I think that the U.S. efforts to reach out to young people, to encourage the growth of young leaders, to make those young leaders pro-American, is probably a smart, you know, decision in terms of the U.S. national interest. But there's only so much that we can do from outside. And I think that there's going to have to be a recognition that, you know, if Africa is really rising, if Africa is really coming forward, then the mantle of leadership and the attitude about where decisions get made and who allocates the funds and who makes those decisions needs to start shifting. The era of paternalism, the era of we know what's best for you because we have expertise or because we're powerful, that era is over. And the U.S. will lag behind if our leaders don't recognize that and respond accordingly.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course.